In other words, it has alternating magnetic dipole moments that are opposing each other, every lattice structure over. So the net magnetic moment is zero, but it's perfectly non-randomly aligned that way. And that's what neodymium does by itself below 20 degrees. Above 20 degrees, it acts like a paramagnetic material, which just means that it'll be magnetic while it's attached to another magnet, but you pull the magnet away, and it's no longer a permanent magnet. Let me drop for a second. So, Rich, I believe.
So, am I correct in assuming that a non-magnetized piece of iron actually can be a paramagnetic material? It's attracted to a magnet, but once the magnet's removed, it basically doesn't stay magnetized. Is that correct?
Well, if you have accurate enough magnetometers, you will find a residual magnetism. It doesn't hold on to all of it, but it holds on to some of it below its Curie point. Now, anti-ferromagnetic material also has a Curie point. So the fact that at 20 degrees Kelvin, the neodymium loses that anti-ferromagnetism is also called a Curie point. Iron has a higher Curie point. Below it, it will lock some of the magnetic dipole moments from the externally introduced magnetic field into its structure and hold on to that. But above a certain temperature, the average kinetic energy is going to knock all the magnetic dipole moments into random order.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So the secret is that neodymium magnets are made out of very little neodymium. It's an alloy of three different ingredients. To every two neodymium atoms, there's one boron atom. Boron isn't paramagnetic, isn't ferromagnetic, isn't even anti-ferromagnetic. Boron is diamagnetic, which means it has no unpaired electrons, and so it actually, in the presence of a external magnetic field, produces its own magnetic field to oppose it. And once the external magnetic field is gone, then it collapses and acts randomly again. So that's boron. But there's 14 atoms of good old iron. So basically, it's an alloy mostly of iron, a little touch of neodymium, and it's sintered together. It's a very interesting form of a crystal it takes in that you have to build the crystal in a magnetic field because the crystal structure itself has a magnetic tendency. It's not fully magnetizing the neodymium alloy, but you have to orient the crystals using an external magnetic field. Then once you pack it together, you plate it in some nickel and chrome if you want to keep it from oxidizing, because oxygen will destroy the alloy, and a good external magnet orients it, and it gets stuck as hard as any other magnet. And the beauty is that neodymium is cheaper than samarium, and you need a lot less of the neodymium to make a neodymium iron boron magnet. So that's my
repeater. Time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
WS2N, let me just review that 1 second, Mark. Let me see if I have it. So neodymium actually has three different phases, more or less. It'll have one where it's below a certain temperature, and it acts one way, and then you get above a certain temperature, and it's going to act another way, and then when you get mixed in with boron and everything, then it's going to become a permanent magnet. Is that right?
In a word, yes. The point is that magnetism is very complicated. Primarily, it's the unshared electrons of the iron that are doing most of the magnetic dipole moment effect. The neodymium and the boron are kind of stabilizing the, it's called remnant in magnets, the ability of it to remember its previous magnetic state from an external magnetic field. So the entire complex of 14 iron atoms, two neodymium atoms, and one boron atom stabilize the ferromagnetism of iron and make it a much more effective magnet. It too has a Curie point, and it's adjustable based upon other impurities that you could use in the alloy mixture by adding other metals and elements to it. You can, at the cost of decreasing its ability as a magnet to hold the magnetism until you reach a higher Curie point.
Okay, well, all I can say is, wow, very good, Roy. I'm going to read up on it. It's a fascinating topic. Wow. So it's definitely a manufactured process. And apparently it took Japan to do this. Is that what you said in the beginning?
It was in some articles, it was a joint project. In other articles, it was a parallel project between General Motors and a Japanese materials manufacturer. But, yeah, it requires a great deal of industrial skill. You have to get the mixture right, and you have to be able to set up the alloy with an external magnetic field before you magnetize it even. So it requires, I think they came up with this solution back in 1980s or so. And as you've noticed, they're all over the damn place. By the way, it's more of a sintered material in that it's kind of powder that's packed very tightly and heated, so it's not really fused well. And if you've ever eaten through the jacket of a neodymium magnet, you'll see the color difference, and it's rather brittle. It's very easy to shatter a neodymium magnet as opposed to samarium cobalt or iron or aluminum nickel or the other alloys that most other magnets are made of. Well, any other questions or comments before I move on to the next topic? VDH.
I think you just mentioned it, but wasn't there Alnico aluminum nickel cobalt used at one time?
That was a very popular alloy. I think it was not used in the same way that the samarium cobalt magnets were used because it just didn't have the strength. But yes, it's a very popular alloy for magnetic materials. I think school magnets were often made out of that.
Yeah, I remember I had a couple from Lafayette Radio over there in Jamaica when I was a kid. Okay, thanks, Ray.
I think the progression was that Alnico 40 years ago was considered a darn good magnet. Then they came along with something that they thought was a super magnet, the samarium cobalt. And they use a lot of samarium cobalt magnets to make microwave tubes. I can't think of the name of the darn things right now. The long linear microwave tubes. And then I guess 20 or so years ago, we came up with neodymium iron cobalt. So there's been three stages of stronger and stronger magnets, as I see it. There is a YouTube video of a guy who is buying a magnet that looks to me like it's about 4 inches in diameter and about 2 inches thick. And I think he buys a pair of them, and they arrive in a great big wooden box. Looks like it's a multi-layer wooden box with a whole bunch of layers of cardboard inside. And he tries to separate these two things and proves that they can do an awful lot of damage if your finger is in the way at the wrong time. But if he made the mistake of heating either one of those to 340 degrees or 350 degrees centigrade, which I think is the Curie temperature, he could probably take what I'm guessing is a $500 magnet and turn it into a piece of junk real fast. Is that true, Roy? KQIW?
Repeater, timeout.
By the way, it was a traveling wave tube, I was trying to think of the name of, which for a while we were being made out of samarium cobalt magnets. Now I think they're being made out of neodymium iron cobalt magnets. Over to you, Roy.
Yeah, my sense is that samarium cobalt is a decent replacement for neodymium. Neodymium might be just a little bit more powerful. It's the cost factor, I think, that just kind of collapsed the entire samarium cobalt industry, because this is a fraction of the cost of that type of technology. But I saw that. I think that guy's name is, at least on the YouTube, is Brainiac78 or something. He either has a German or a Swedish accent, and he shows these enormous discs. They can be incredibly dangerous. I don't know if anyone has played with neodymium magnets more than the teeny tiny ones, but they can generate enough force that if you put one on one side of your finger and the other on the other side of your finger, you don't have a finger bone anymore to speak of. So be very cautious. I mean, I actually have a tool to separate these neodymium magnets, because they have something like 200, 300, 400 pounds of force attracting them, and I'm just not into weight building, so I have this little tool. So yes, you're quite right, Dick. If you heat a neodymium magnet past its curie point, you basically have a paperweight that's very expensive, but you're not going to break any bones with it.
That YouTube video where he got these pair of very strong hockey pucks that arrive in a plywood box. How expensive do you think they are? That's question number one. And question number two is, how big is the biggest neodymium magnet that you presently own, Roy Dad?
Since I'm basically a coward, I'm not a really big one. I think my biggest one is a ball that's about an inch and a half in diameter. That's probably the chunkiest neodymium that I have. I would assume that at those sizes, they cost in the hundreds of dollars, perhaps as much as a thousand and change. Like I said, I saw that they had purchased or been given by the company two of these enormous blocks of neodymium, and it was a great deal of work involved of squeezing them together without cracking one or getting something trapped in the middle of one, and they still ended up getting a small sliver of plastic in the delivery device wedged into it for all eternity. So they weren't 100% successful, but they're incredible things, but they're incredibly dangerous.
And putting a magnet like that near a human head and moving the head rapidly, I think could be a dangerous procedure. Go ahead.
I would agree with you, because as we've talked before, magnetic fields and electrolytic fluids in vessels and such don't go together well, and you'll induce electrical potentials, and that could be very, very dangerous. Thankfully, the Brainiac 78, I've never seen him actually attempt any kind of organic test. It's a great YouTube if anyone's interested in magnets. He does a lot of tricks with them. He does a lot of experiments with what's ferromagnetic, what's paramagnetic, what's diamagnetic, and all manner of things. So if you have nothing better to do, check out Brainiac 78 and his playing with magnets. It's a lot safer and a lot cheaper to watch it on YouTube than to do it for yourself. One last call for anything, any questions about magnets before I move on to the next item.
That YouTube guy calls himself Brainiac78, I think you said. Now, Brainiac, I can make some guesses as to where he came up with that, but what does the number 78 indicate?
If I had to guess, I would guess that that was his year of birth.
Makes sense.
mean, sometimes it's much vaguer, but when it's in the range of post-baby boom birth, those numbers tend to be usually more related to the year of birth than anything else. But I don't know for sure, and I don't think he's ever mentioned it.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
So, this Curie temperature in relation to magnetism, how does that relate to the big magnet that we all know and love, the Earth's core, churning and generating, I guess, molten iron ore? Does that have any effect on the amount of magnetism produced vis-a-vis the temperature of that core?
In a word, no. It's inducing the magnetic field with its temperature and rotation. So it's an ongoing affair. It's not the same as a fixed ferromagnetic piece of material. So it's always kind of regenerating. My surmise is if you stop the dynamic nature of the iron core, the magnetic field would probably collapse if you kept the temperature the way it is.
Roy, when it comes to the Curie temperature of roughly 350 centigrade for a neodymium iron cobalt magnet, does the magnetic field simply flip and instantaneously jump to zero when you hit that temperature? Or is it one of these somewhat gradual things that you slowly lose more and more magnetism as you get closer and closer to that temperature? And the second related question, is that part of what's going on when you look up neodymium, you find out the Curie is 350 centigrade, but the working temperature is something like 150 to 200. Is working temperature the temperature at which you start losing magnetic field toward Curie when you go hotter? Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
Yeah, Dick, I mean, all these things are equilibrium equations, so nothing happens on zero time frame. The problem with giving a Curie temperature as an absolute is you get the sense that there's this avalanche effect, that absolutely nothing and then everything, and it happens instantaneously, and nature doesn't like instantaneous things. So, yeah, to a degree, it's statistically an average decline in holding on to magnetic dipole moments. Some are lost at lower temperatures. Some are lost at higher temperatures. By the time you reach the Curie point, though, statistically, 99% of the magnetic domains have randomized.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Good. Any other questions or comments about magnetism for tonight?
WA2MHL. With the magnets being heated up and losing their magnetism, what about when they cool down? Do they regain the magnetism that they had to begin with?
In a word, no. The point is that magnetic dipole moments without any kind of external magnetic field tend to be random occurrences statistically. So you would have to expose ferromagnetic material to an external magnetic field in order to align the magnetic poles and magnetize the ferromagnet. Once you did that, since the ferromagnet has remnants, it will get kind of stuck in that position. If you heat it up to the Curie point and beyond, you randomize the magnetic dipoles again, and you return them to their nation's state of random, non-magnetized when they were first taken out of the kiln, if you will. You can remagnetize them by introducing them to another very strong external magnetic field. But a Curie point is a one-way trip unless you have an external magnetic field to start with.
A very large retentivity or coercivity of a neodymium magnet. The process of magnetizing it to the strength at which you get it when you buy it, I am guessing that that external magnetic field, probably an electromagnet, has to be 2 or 3 times stronger than the frontal magnetic field you intend to get out of your neodymium magnet. Is that roughly true, Roy? That must be one hell of a structure.
Yeah, you want a very strong field to align as many domains as humanly possible. And it makes no sense to use anything other than electromagnets, because you can turn electromagnets off and not have too much of a problem after you've magnetized the neodymium magnets. The interesting quirk with neodymium, as I mentioned before, is that you sort of have to align the lattice structure while you're forming the alloy in an external magnetic field as well. This is not necessary, to my understanding, with samarium cobalt or aluminum nickel cobalt or basic iron. But it is absolutely necessary with neodymium magnets.
I think many of the stainless steels are essentially non-magnetic. What's magic about stainless steel that makes that happen, Roy?
Stainless steel is magnetic.
Not necessarily. It depends upon what kind of stainless steel and if it's hardened stainless steel. The problem with steel is that steel is more than one type of a crystal. There's austenite and there's another one that I can't remember. One has is magnetic and the other one is very weakly magnetic. So some do and some don't. Unfortunately, it would be nice if it was an absolute. But Rich has something to say about that.
Saying a lot of my stainless steel silverware, it's not silverware, a lot of my stainless steel flatware is magnetic.
Okay, well, like I said, I mean, there's some that are magnetic, and there's other alloys that are called a stainless steel that aren't magnetic. So you can't rely on one or the other, unfortunately.
Your flatware that you're talking about, is it paramagnetic or ferromagnetic? In other words, you bring it near a magnet and it gets attracted. However, you bring it away from a magnet, does it have any remaining magnetic field? Over to you, Rich.
Most annoyingly, it actually stays magnetic. There's a bunch of it in the drawer right now that is magnetic, right there.
So they tend to stick together in ways that is a little bit annoying when you want to arrange them a certain way, is what I think you're saying.
Basically, I also don't like unusual surprises, and magnets present unusual surprises, obviously.
Rich, have you ever tried those little demagnetizing devices that are sold? They pretty much work well.
Not yet. Haven't bothered with the flatware, but they will come in handy with old magnetic tape recorders and stuff.
Okay, yeah, unfortunately, magnetic fields are used in all kinds of things. It's sort of being phased out in favor of solid-state methods of recording data, but there's still a lot of credit cards with magnetic strips on them.
Yes, and the problem comes when people who don't know or care much about magnetism wave these things around, as I have said previously, with magnetic media that doesn't like magnetism around it.
I agree with you. It's very problematic. Matter of fact, one of my amateur radio badges that I have is held together with magnets, so it doesn't rip any of the fabric where I'm wearing it. And I got to be very careful, because if I put it next to my Metro card, I don't have a Metro card anymore.
Hard to hear, but voila.
What can you do? Modern times have modern problems. You know, at least we don't have to worry about buggy whips breaking.
WA2MHL with electromagnets. If you reverse the current, your positive and negative that you're charging with, do you reverse the north-south poles of the magnet?
As long as the power level that you're using is sufficient, you can not only demagnetize a magnet, but reverse its magnetic poles. You can even do that with neodymium, because it's a longitudinal orientation. You would have a problem if you change the orientation of the crystals and tried to remagnetize them. Then you'd have some kind of problem getting it up to the specs that you'd want. Okay, one last call. If anyone has any question about magnets, I find magnets fascinating, as no doubt you've noticed. Anyone have any questions? Otherwise, I'll move on to the usual stories. Okie dokie. The detection of gravitational waves have always been a popular topic in these little science talk segments. Well, the United Kingdom and the United States have announced a $35 million upgrade to the Advanced Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, or as we love to call it, ALIGO. The improvement will see the twin observatories located near Hanford, Washington and Livingston, Louisiana in the United States double their sensitivity to gravitational waves. Work on the upgrade will start in 2023 and will be completed 2 years later. Each LIGO facility works by sending twin laser beams down 2 4-kilometer-long tubes. That's approximately 2.5 miles. Arranged as an L shape, they are kept under a near-perfect vacuum. The beams are reflected back down the tubes by mirrors precisely positioned at the end of each arm. As a gravitational wave passes through the observatory, it causes extremely tiny distortions in the distance traveled by each laser beam. LIGO was first turned on in 2002 and was upgraded between 2010 and 2015 to improve the facility's ability to spot gravitational waves by a factor of 10. Let me drop for a second. Thanks to this $221 million earlier upgrade, known as Advanced LIGO or ALIGO, researchers can detect gravitational waves that originate anywhere within a sphere of about 420 million light years in radius, centered on our lovely planet Earth. That breakthrough was announced in February 2016 when researchers working in ALIGO directly detected gravitational waves for the first time in an event in September 2015 when ALIGO was being calibrated. The waves were produced from the collision of 2 black holes of 36 and 29 solar masses, respectively, which merged to form a spinning 62 solar mass black hole some 1.3 billion light years away in an event called GW150914. The findings ended the decades-long hunt for these ripples in space-time and marked the beginning of a new era of gravitational wave astronomy that has since resulted in about 10 gravitational wave events being detected, including from the merger of 2 neutron stars, which we've discussed here before. Let me drop for a second. While ALIGO is set to begin another operating run in the next couple of months, plans are now afoot to boost its sensitivity even further. The United States National Science Foundation announced recently that it would provide $20.4 million for a further upgrade to the facility, dubbed ALIGO Plus. The United Kingdom's Research and Innovation Agency, meanwhile, will provide a further $14.1 million. With additional support from the Australian Research Council. The upgrades will include applying new coatings to the mirrors to reduce thermal noise, as well as improvements to the laser system. ALIGO Plus's capabilities are expected to probe the origins of the evolution of stellar mass black holes as allow and allow precision tests of extreme gravity and enable detailed studies of the equation of the state of neutron stars. This award ensures that LIGO will continue to lead in gravitational wave science for the next decade, said the National Science Foundation's director, Franz Cordova. These detections may reveal secrets from the inside supernova and teach us about the extreme physics from the first seconds after the universe's birth. Let me drop it for a second. Upgrade will see the observatory being able to detect binary black hole collisions on an almost daily basis, they say. The improvements will also be made as standards to the planned LIGO facility in India, which, if built, is expected to come online in 2025. Brave new world, this is. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2. Yes.
GXO.
Yes, Rich.
Do the improvements include lengthening any of the tunnels? WB2GXM.
I do not believe so. That's a really heavy-duty job. That probably will knock them out for much longer. So they're just kind of tweaking and fine-tuning the present design parameters. Any other questions or comments on the subject, or I'll move on to the next one.
Oh, yeah, this VDH. Do they use more than one reflection down each tunnel? Aren't there multiple reflections to lengthen the effective path?
So it's probably some aspect of the computer program that there's a series of reflections because the mirrors are something like 50% transmission, 50% reflection. So yeah, you get a statistical bounce back and forth to lengthen the perceived distances.
Roy, I think down each 4-kilometer tunnel, the mirror at the far end, I think, has a large number of parallel beams. You know, one beam with a slight misalignment, so it's hitting the mirror, let me pick a number, 50 times. There's a partially silvered mirror at the point of cancellation in the center of the array. But I think they've got a large number of beams going down each tunnel, so that the equivalent length is a lot longer than 4 kilometers. Over to you, Roy.
Okay, I'll have to do a little bit more research on the subject. Always looking to do research on stuff. That would make sense. I don't know. I'll wait until I look at the specs and figure it out a little bit better. Any other questions or comments before we move on? Okay. For any of you out there with way too much money and too little sense of self-preservation, the Russians have a great deal for you. Russia has flown just 7 tourists to space since 2001, but it's about to expand that number in the near future. The country's space agency, Roscosmos, has signed a deal with Space Adventures to carry 2 spaceflight participants, otherwise known as tourists, to the International Space Station in late 2021. They'll fly aboard a familiar Soyuz spacecraft for a short-duration trip. The guests haven't been named, although it's safe to presume they'll have a large bank account. Roscosmos wasn't shy about the motivation to take on these tourists. It noted that these travelers were helping to fund Russia's space flight industry, including future Soyuz vehicles. The publicity is almost secondary. This is as much about supporting future missions as anything else. The 2021 launch will take place under different circumstances, though. Space tourism won't be as novel then as it is now, with companies like Virgin Galactic aiming to take non-astronauts into space before then. This could easily be one flight among many, rather than the novelty it once was. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2. Yes.
WS2N. Over the years, they've done it 9 different times. They've taken a single, single seat people up to the space station. and now it looks like they're going to use two at one time. So that coincides with the Dragon crew vehicle and also the Starliner by Boeing. So we'll be bringing our own people up. And as it was, the Russians were cutting back anyway. Few flights, they wanted to just take two people up, a Russian and an American, you know, maybe an American, and that would be it. Leave the third person out. Because, they, you know, they would sometimes bring up two Russians. So they felt there was no need for two or three Russians at a time. So I guess what they're doing is they want to fill those seats. We pay $70 million each every time we put an astronaut on board that thing. Back to you, Ryan.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. I don't know, you know, I understand millionaires want a thrill and want a thrill ride, but I don't know if I'd gamble on Russian spacecraft. You know, it kind of works most of the time, but then sometimes it just doesn't. So I wish everyone good luck on this one.
I concur with that.
Yes, indeed. Well, any other questions or comments on the subject, or I'll move on. Next, I'm going to talk about the asteroid Ryugu. I think Paul also is going to do a little bit on Ryugu. It's sort of a fascinating little story. Okay, we've talked about the asteroid Ryugu and Japan's spacecraft, Hayabusa 2, before. Japan has been having a hard time deciding on the best approach to land their spacecraft onto the surface of Ryugu. This past Thursday evening, though, it touched down on the asteroid Ryugu. Then it fired a 5-gram tantalum bullet into the rocky surface and thus ascended back into orbit around the tiny world, according to updates from the mission's English-language Twitter account. During its brief contact with the asteroid, the spacecraft should have attempted to collect rock samples picked up by the bullet, the Planetary Society explained. The return of these samples to the Earth is a major goal of this mission. The Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency has been preparing for Hayabusa 2 to make contact with the asteroid for months. The touchdown was previously delayed after scientists found that the asteroid's surface was rougher than they had earlier anticipated. While scientists had originally thought that Ryugu's surface would be a kind of powdery, fine regolith, the Mascot and Minerva 2-1 rovers dropped by the spacecraft were greeted instead with a larger-than-expected gravel. Let me drop for a second. Though its original touchdown date of October was delayed, mission scientists were able to conduct tests back here on Earth to further prepare for Hayabusa 2's eventual contact with the asteroid. In addition, they made sure that the spacecraft would still be able to collect its surface samples. The mission scientists were also able to reassess its landing site. Hayabusa 2 launched in 2014 and took the long way to get there, rather than a fuel-wasting direct approach. Hayabusa 2 was designed to leisurely spiral outward from the Earth's orbit into a wider one where Ryugu is presently orbiting itself. The spacecraft spent 4 years traveling to its target. The spacecraft successfully reached Ryugu in June of last year, at which time mission scientists determined the landing sites for its rover. Let me drop for a second. NASA has its own asteroid mission underway. The spacecraft OSIRIS-REx arrived at the asteroid Bennu in December 2018, and I previously posted an image taken from that spacecraft of the object's south pole. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2. Yes. It's a fascinating little rocket. They use hydrogen-oxygen fuel, and they also use ion drive. So it's a interesting little thing. And it's kind of amusing that their propulsion system to get off of the asteroid was a 5-gram bullet of tantalum.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
You'll see the picture that I sent to you has the spacecraft with the four ion engines, but they show three that are on, one is a backup. And so this thing is very well made, and when it does deliver its package, it's going to take, I think, three or four different samples. It's going to separate them, and when it gets sent back to Earth, the spacecraft keeps going. It's going to be whizzing past Earth, so it's going to just drop off the capsule for return, but the spacecraft will go on to an extended mission, and with those ion engines, it's really going to be something. Also has four gyros, momentum wheels for orientation, and they're all working right now too, so it's in good shape. Better than a Hayabusa 1. That wasn't as good.
Yeah, Paul, thanks. I wish them all well. There's no real report that I've read that they definitively collected samples. The concept was that in the getting off of the asteroid, they would shoot the bullet, and some of the pebbles would kind of ricochet into some catching device, and that they would travel back to Earth's orbit and drop off the gift package on its way wherever. It's kind of interesting. The ion drive is based on about 66 kilograms of xenon. Basically, they ionize it using the solar batteries and such, and add propulsion that way. So it's a fascinating object. I wish them well. It certainly requires a great deal of patience because, you know, like I said, they took the long way to get there. It's been 4 years in the making, and it's going to be a couple more years before we get anything out of it other than what we have.
Yeah, this is the end of 2020, December, that will enter the atmosphere. And they're going to actually send it to Australia, you know, out to the desert of Australia for their landing recovery.
Well, probably it's the closest desert area that's not politically disputed that the Japanese can ask a favor of people.
Yes. Well, they've already, of course, made those arrangements a long time ago. And the launch on their own rocket, you know, they have the H-2A rocket, which they use quite a bit. I think it's had many, many flights. Similar to the H-2B. H-2B is the one that is very similar to that, but a little different. And that's the one that brings up the cargo vehicle. They have their own cargo vehicle to dock with the International Space Station. So Japan has two launch complexes and two launch vehicles pretty much that they deal with. And like you said, they're liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. But enough to do what they need to do with these. They've done quite a few interplanetary flights so far, so they're doing quite well. Back to you, Rick.
Yes, thank you very much, Paul. I wish them well. My attitude is the more the merrier. I don't worry about challenges from other nations. You know, this isn't a competition. This is a search for wisdom. So everyone interested with a couple of shekels to drop on a project is fine by me.
Yeah, the science is shared, just like the Osiris Rex. We're going to share information with them. They usually put some kind of instrument or part of an instrument or involved, you know, on our spacecraft, and we usually do the same, and in turn they exchange information. So it's a good thing for all.
There's nothing wrong with more information. The more, the better. Okay, for my last item for the night, for anyone out there that thinks that all this space stuff is just a conspiracy and we live on a flat Earth, there's good news for you. You can blame all this on the Internet. As listeners to these segments might have guessed, I'm a big fan of YouTube. mentioned it tonight. There are wonderful explorations into technology, recharge on the website, provided you have a well-calibrated BS meter. The wisdom that YouTube imparts on some of its channels, it tends to remove with other channels. It's the inherent nature of all tools. They can be used to create, but they can also be used to destroy. Now, despite steps taken to counteract problematic material, YouTube is still a hotbed of hoaxes and fake news, a problem that's become so prevalent that the site recently announced it's changing its artificial intelligence in a bid to improve matters. But now the scope of the problem has really come to light, as new research suggests that the increasing number of flat earthers can be attributed to conspiracy videos posted on that site. Let me drop for a second. According to Ashley Landrum, assistant professor of science communication at Texas Tech University, all but one of 30 flat earthers interviewed said they had considered the Earth, they hadn't considered the Earth to be flat until watching videos promoting the theory on YouTube. Presenting her results at the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Washington, D.C., Landrum said that most were recommended videos after watching clips about other conspiracies, such as alternative 9/11 theories and fake moon landing theories. Landrum's interest in the topic was first piqued after she attended the world's largest gathering of flat earthers at the movement's annual conference in Raleigh, North Carolina, back in 2017. Now, she visited the conference again in 2018 when it took place in Denver, Colorado, to interview a number of attendees. According to Landrum, the one person who didn't point to YouTube as the catalyst of their opinion change had their minds changed by family members who themselves were convinced by YouTube videos. Let me drop for a second. As artificial intelligence expert Guillaume Chazlot explained on a Twitter earlier this month, conspiracy theory videos tend to be promoted by YouTube's artificial intelligence more than fact-based videos, because platforms that use artificial intelligence often become biased by small groups of very active users. This explains why Microsoft's artificial intelligence chatbot Tay, that we talked about on Science Talk just the other week, it became basically a racist nightmare in less than 24 hours when it was left in the care of Twitter users. Try and stay away from those Twitter users. Anyway, according to Landrum, YouTube isn't doing anything wrong, but it could be doing more to protect viewers from misinformation. Their algorithms make it easy to end up going down the rabbit hole by presenting information to people who are going to be more susceptible to it. She called the scientists and other creators to make their own videos to counteract the slew of conspiracy theories. We don't want the YouTube to be full of videos saying, here are all these reasons the Earth is flat. We need other videos saying, here's why all those reasons aren't real, and here's a bunch of ways you can research it for yourself. So as I've always advised, take any new information with a dash of healthy skepticism, and make sure your BS meter is always well calibrated. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2, yes.
The Earth isn't flat?
Best I can offer you is it's very, very slightly up late. And some flat earthers have been very upset with that term up late because they want it to be squashed. And it is up late, but it's not terribly up late.
I just want to know what is on the bottom of the flat earth. KD2PPF. Checking in from 6,200 feet near Denver. Sorry, guys. Yeah, what's on the bottom, they think?
It's a very good question that they don't address in the slightest. If you look at the YouTube, there seems to be... It's somewhat biblical in nature because they go back to the pre-Greek belief that it's a flat slab with a dome, and the dome has heaven in it, and at the edges they draw the icy glaciers of apparently both the North and South Pole that seem to meet and kind of wall in the world, so you can't fall off of it. They also don't tend to believe in gravity as well. So it's a curious group of people. But they never really talk about the underside. One of the greatest stories I ever heard, I think Carl Sagan used to tell it repeatedly, was he gave a little presentation on the Big Bang and the beginning of the universe, and a little old lady came by and tapped him on the shoulder and said, "You know, you got it all wrong. The Earth sits on the shell of a giant tortoise." And Carl Sagan supposedly said the same thing that you asked. Well, what's supporting the tortoise? And she said, another tortoise. And there's a tortoise below that. And it's basically just tortoises all the way down.
Roger, Roger, back to that. Very interesting. I'm glad to see you guys from out here. I'm glad to chime in and be able to hear you guys. Over. KD2PVIP, I'm clear. Listening.
Very good, Matt. I tell you, Echolink is very nice. IRLP is very nice. You know, we have people all the way in Australia. Shout out to VK2DY Robert in Australia. So Echolink is a very nice thing. So anyway, anyone have any other questions or comments before I wrap it up? Okie doke, this has been the Science Talk. I am AC2GS. And again, if you have any topics, the subjects, questions, answers, reputations, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you want to read the articles that are the basis for some of these discussions, my link page is roy.ac2gs.com. And that's it for this week. Hopefully I'll be back next week with more puzzles if I can think them up, and more interesting subjects. So I want to thank everyone who participated, and thank Dick and Paul as always, and I'll send it off to Dick, and so he can send it off to Paul for the space report.
Very interesting for me, Roy. Thank you very much. And I'm pretty sure other people feel pretty much the same. Well done. And lots of people got a chance to see you today. And by the way, if I did see you face-to-face, would I be looking at a tall, blonde, Nordic-looking guy, about 190 pounds and 6'2" tall, and blue eyes? Is that approximately what I would see, Roy? Over you for a quick one, for a BS detection.
Okay, yeah, that would be a great way of calibrating your own BS meter. No, you would see a 6'1", brown-haired, hazel-eyed, slightly overweight, scruffy-bearded gentleman.
Okay, thank you very much. Paul, time for us to hear about space and more of the fine details of Ryugu, R-Y-U-G-U, and Hayabusa, two mission and so on. WS2N, K2IW, go ahead, Paul.
Okay, very good. Yeah, we'll get off the Flat Earth Society. Although I remember years ago I listened to the one guy on TV, and he said, you know, the Earth is flat. And the other guy said, no, it's round. Look at everything around. The sun, the moon, it's all round. No, it's still flat. Look, the moon is flat. It's not like a ball. It's like a dish. Like a dinner dish. See, it's flat. You know, those stories go way back. I remember the Carl Sagan, I think that's in one of his books, about the frogs on top of one another. Very well done, Roy. Okay, last week there was another flight of Spaceship Two. Spaceship Two flies for Virgin Galactic. That's that Richard Branson. He's built that company up now. They've tested this spaceship five different times now. They take this space plane up on a carrier plane called White Knight 2, jet powered, and it brings it up to 45,000 feet, and then they drop it like an atomic bomb. And they have pilot, co-pilot inside. They point it upwards, and they light the hybrid engine, and they try to light it up to about a minute. Each time they increase the time that it stays lit, and therefore the height. So out of the five flights that this thing has made with an engine in it, the last two now flights have gone above 50 miles, which according to the FAA, if you go up above 50 miles, that's officially in space. The international requirement is 62 miles or 100 kilometers. So, two guys that went last time tested it, got their astronaut wings because of that. And on this flight last Thursday, they took a passenger up with them. Beth Moses works for the company. She's worked on the seating of the astronauts and the equipment and how things are going to be back in the cabin. The idea of this whole spaceship to space plane by Virgin Galactic is to have paying customers. They plan on putting like six people in at a time, paying customers, plus the pilot and co-pilot, and blast themselves into outer space. So all suborbital, they get up to around 3.5 times the speed of sound. So they shut the engine off, they keep coasting up, they get about 5 minutes of loading free. In fact, Beth disconnected the seatbelt and floated around the cabin to test things out. And it's interesting to see the picture of her inside. I didn't see a video, but I've seen that still picture. And you have the pilot, co-pilot, and they're in what essentially looks like almost a spacesuit. It's really a flight suit. So if they lost pressure, they'd be okay. She didn't have any of that on. She's floating around in the back. And so I guess they're feeling very confident. So it's the first time a passenger's been in there. They're going to fly quite a few more flights, I understand, maybe four or five more before they go commercial. The first flight, the actual flight they're going to bring passengers up, will be Richard Branson. This guy's a daredevil anyway. He loves this stuff, and he plans on going up, I think, with a family member too. So look forward to that. I hope it works out. This is their second spacecraft. Back in 2012, Spaceship One crashed in one of these tests. It was the same size, it was the same type of deal. But the crash and killed one of the test pilots. What happens is, when they go up into space, they need to come back, and to slow their descent, this thing kind of like splits in half. The back half of the tail of it splits down the middle, and it closes about 60 degrees in relationship to the run of the fuselage itself. And it was coasted all the way back, kind of like a birdie in badminton. This way the nose always stays pointed down. And when it gets a little lower, eventually it straightens itself back out again and comes back and lands on a runway. Well, during Spaceship One, when they had the accident, apparently there was no safety on the switch or lever or whatever they were using to make this spacecraft split in half like that. And the pilot, apparently, they said, hit a button or did something inadvertently as they first split their engine, and now they're going like 600-700 miles an hour, starting to accelerate, and they're still in the atmosphere, and this thing started to separate from, as if it was in space as they were coming down, and it just blew apart, and that was it. The commander of it got back okay, but the co-pilot did not.
But that was many years ago. They've changed everything. They've built this thing up better. Changed the engine. Changed a lot of things on, you know, Spaceship 2. It looks kind of like the same Spaceship 1, but there's a lot of basic differences. So, inside probably about a year, maybe less than that, paying passengers paying up to around $250,000 each will be taking rides on.